Hello, this is David Murphy. Today is February 20th, 2026. I will be reading The New Yorker, publication date of February 23rd, 2026. I begin with the chaos of an ICE detention. When Manuela's husband texted her that he'd been apprehended on the street, her life in New York instantly capsized. By Jordan Samana. At 11 minutes to 8 o'clock on the morning of January 27th in Corona, Queens, Manuela, a 23-year-old undocumented immigrant from Ecuador, was about to wake up her daughter when she received a string of panicked "What's up?" messages from her husband, Ivan. "Mammy, migration got me," Ivan, who is also undocumented, wrote. It was one of 17 frantic texts punctuated by typos and sobbing emojis in the course of 3 minutes. "My God, no, my love, pay my phone bill. Please, mommy, I don't have phone signal. They were just outside. They grabbed me, three of them, and they're taking me away." He'd stepped out of the house only minutes earlier and was heading to his job with a roofing contractor when he walked right into a group of federal agents near Roosevelt Avenue. Ivan was clearly terrified. He had never been convicted of a crime, Manuela told me, but he did have a deportation order to his name. He'd missed the scheduled immigration hearing early last year. Manuela said that his hearing date had been changed, but they had not been notified. It's likely that his notice to appear had arrived at an old address. When Ivan was detained, his mind leapt to Manuela and Nicole, their 3-year-old daughter, who lived with him in a rented semi-basement room up the street. He sent Manuela the text so that she would know what had happened to him, and in the hope that she would pay his cell phone bill. It had been due a day earlier, and he was evidently desperate for his phone to continue working so that he could contact her later from wherever ICE had taken him. In fact, immigration authorities routinely remove migrants' phones and other personal belongings. Ivan wouldn't be able to respond to any messages or calls after being apprehended. With the notable exception of the harrowing arrests at Immigration Courthouse downtown, the scale of ICE activity in New York City hasn't been close to what has been seen in such places as Minneapolis or Southern California. Still, neighborhood coalitions in Queens frequently share reports of active federal agents in migrant-dense areas, including Corona, East Elmhurst, and Jackson Heights. A video recently shared with the news outlet The City shows agents bursting into an East Elmhurst home and threatening a mother who is holding her baby. "Put your fucking hands up, stupid," one agent says. In a pre-dawn raid in Jackson Heights, scores of militarized agents from the Department of Homeland Security descended with assault weapons on a residential building, removing a man and a woman from their apartment. ICE is said to frequently use the parking lots of a CVS pharmacy and a TD Bank on Northern Boulevard as staging areas, and the agency appears to be most active in the early morning when men like Ivan are on their way to work. Manuela's life had turned in an instant. A foot of snow had just fallen in New York City, and the morning was frigid, but she had otherwise been preparing for a normal day. She would walk Nicole to a free preschool run by a Catholic charity center, and she would continue her search for a job. Now, her husband wasn't coming back. She knew nothing about where he was being taken or how to reach him. Frantic and crying, Manuela called her mother, a middle-aged farmer in the remote central highlands of Ecuador, from so far away and not knowing where else to turn, sent a WhatsApp audio message to me. In 2024, I was reporting an article about Ecuadorian migrants for this magazine, and I had interviewed her and Manuela, who was then preparing to join IVENT in New York. Yes, good evening, good morning, may God bless you, how are you? Even in this emergency, Manuela's mother began her voice note in Quechua accented Spanish with a series of formal salutations. My son-in-law was in Queens, New York, and he was caught by migration, and he was taken away. My daughter is crying. He was taken just now, over there, in Queens, New York, You wouldn't have a way of getting a lawyer, would you? Please help me. Manuela and I had kept in touch occasionally since her arrival in New York in August of 2024, but it was challenging to keep track of her. She changed phone numbers a couple of times, and sometimes my messages went unanswered, or they were never delivered at all. Mostly, I learned something new from her if she reached out first about where she was living, who she was spending time with, or how she and her little girl were faring. After receiving a message from Manuela's mom that day, I wrote to Manuela on Facebook Messenger, the only way I was sure of getting through. What happened? I asked. This time she responded within seconds. My husband was caught by immigration, she confirmed, before adding, Buenos dias. Switching to her latest WhatsApp number, she sent me a screenshot of the final messages Ivan had texted her. She also sent photographs of documents that had been generated when he first crossed into the country, illegally, in April of 2024, and was intercepted by U.S. Border Patrol officers in the desert near Sasebo, Arizona. Printed on one of these sheets was his A number, short for Alien Registration Number, a unique numerical code assigned to non-citizen immigrants, including undocumented border crossers and green card holders. Manuela could now use Ivan's A number to search for him in ICE's online data detainee locator system. But at first, the system produced no results. He hadn't been processed yet. Some 4 hours had passed since Ivan was detained, and Manuela still had no idea where he was. At the same time, she was facing a growing list of responsibilities and decisions, with few resources to inform her choices. Chief among those questions was whether she should stay in the U.S. to wait for her husband's case to be resolved. Would he be deported quickly or held indefinitely? Would he be sent to Ecuador or somewhere else? She did not have the money to wait for more than a few days. She had only $500 in cash, and $800 in rent was due in 5 days. On the 1st of February, Ivan had finally found some steady work, but Manuela had struggled to find work ever since arriving in the U.S. Mostly, she looked after Nicole. Without her husband, she was essentially alone in the country and had no close family to lean on. Both she and Nicole were also undocumented, though their immigration cases were still in progress. And she had a court date scheduled for April. I don't know if I should go to Ecuador or not, Manuela told me. Her mother was encouraging her to use a little money she had to buy plane tickets for her and Nicole. but others tell me to stay and to wait for him to try to make it back to this country, dot, dot, dot. I don't know what to do, dot, dot, dot. I'm not working, and that scares me the most. At around 1 o'clock that afternoon, Ivan finally called her. He said he'd been told that he would be deported to Ecuador in 8 days. By the evening, he was in an ICE preliminary holding area at Federal Plaza in downtown Manhattan. He said that it's very bad there, and he doesn't want to stay locked up, Manuela told me. Later that night, I asked her if she decided what to do. I'll drop my daughter off at preschool, she texted, close to midnight, and see if I know anything new about my husband. The next morning, Manuela seemed more hopeful. I want to get a lawyer to see about getting him out of there, she texted me. She had spoken with some of Ivan's relatives who lived in the Bronx. They wanted to find legal help, which she understood was very expensive, not to mention the fact that, given that a removal order for Ivan had already been in place for nearly a year, his fate was likely sealed. But after all they had been through as a couple, surviving separate journeys from Ecuador and forging a new life in America for themselves, Manuela was not ready to give up so easily. I want to provide a better life for my daughter, she told me. The little that Manuela knew about how to navigate life in the United States came from what other migrants had told her directly, and from what she saw on TikTok and Facebook, which wasn't always reliable. Even more than other indigenous Ecuadorian migrants I have come to know over the past several years, she lived a particularly precarious life in New York. Manuela, who had limited formal schooling, had trouble writing. This was clear from her texts, in which she constantly used K's for K, Q-U-E, and A for A-H, and combined and misspelled most words. This made even the simplest bureaucratic tasks very difficult. She'd never found her way to the sort of nonprofits that offer legal services to migrants in the city, learning that they existed only after her husband was detained. She and Ivan still owed more than $15,000 to a financial cooperative in Ecuador that had lent them more than $20,000 for their treks through South and Central America and into the United States. Both of their families, indigenous Paraha farmers, were incredibly poor. Ivan had left first after his mother had developed an aggressive cancer. He was determined to find the money to pay for her treatments. He left to save his mother, but she died when he was still on his way, Manuela told me. By then, he had already walked across the Darien Gap and was somewhere in Mexico. He couldn't turn back. Manuela and Nicole, then just 2 years old, followed him once he'd safely arrived in New York. Avoiding the Darien Gap, they flew from Peru to Colombia to El Salvador. After she and Nicole made it to Mexico, they were locked up by smugglers who extorted the family for an additional $1,000 to ensure their safe passage. Amid the vast wave of new migrants and asylum seekers looking for work in New York, Manuela and Ivan struggled to earn enough money. Before their first winter set in, they'd moved to Rochester, where Manuela's became a housekeeper at a hotel. But their marriage nearly buckled under the pressure. In January 2025, Manuela sent me a message asking how she and Nicole could get to Chicago, where a cousin lived. She had decided to separate from Ivan. she said, because he spent a lot of time drinking with male friends, despite her objections. But she had no way to leave, and they were still living together. I just want to go away, she said. An uncle in Queens intervened to mitigate the crisis. He didn't let me separate, Manuela told me. Her parents also did not want her to leave Ivan, so she stayed. A few days later, she posted on WhatsApp a video of her husband and daughter decorated with numerous praying hands emojis. We all deserve a second chance, she told me by way of explanation. But if he doesn't value it, in time I could end up separating after all. By June of 2025, they had moved back to Queens. When they returned to the city, they found Ivan's removal order waiting for him, signed by a judge. After her husband was detained, Manuela imagined what would happen if she went back to Ecuador. It certainly wouldn't solve her financial problems. Her family would never be able to pay back their debt. The financial cooperative would take her father's truck, which had been used as collateral. She feared that her family might even end up in jail. That's why we don't want to go back yet, she continued to insist. I'm going to get my husband out. Whatever hope she had of his quick release began to fade by the afternoon of his second day in detention. Ivan called Manuela again to say that he'd been transferred to a new facility in New Jersey. The online locator system had updated to show that he was now being held at Delaney Hall, a notorious privately run detention center in Newark. He told Manuela that she urgently needed to deposit money in his detention account so that he could keep calling her with updates. He provided her with a telephone number and a PIN for making the deposits. She didn't have time to find a piece of paper, so she scribbled the numbers down on the wall above the light switch in her room. I have no idea where I have to go to make the deposit, she told me. I didn't know either. Eventually, she found her way to a money transfer office near 103rd Street and deposited $20, with the exception of taking her daughter to and from the daycare center. It was the first time she had left her room since Ivan's arrest. They spoke again on the phone. He told her that he had offered her name and other information to the ICE agents because he thought that it would make it easier for them to all leave voluntarily together. Manuela wasn't happy about this. She worried that agents would now track her down and arrest her, too. The rest of the weeks passed with little new information from Ivan's calls. By the third day, Manuela learned that he was being fed very little. He hardly had an appetite, though. He was very cold from sleeping on the floor and had started feeling sick. They don't even give him a blanket, she told me, after his only call of the day. A DHS official denied that there were hostile conditions at the center where Ivan was being held, saying, ICE has the highest detention standards than most U.S. prisons that hold actual U.S. citizens. Manuela wasn't making any headway on finding a lawyer. In truth, she told me, she didn't know where to begin. Manuela passed the days in her room, fielding calls from close relatives in Ecuador and from more distant ones in Queens, all of whom asked her for updates that she couldn't provide. Despondent, she downloaded the CBP Home app, which the U.S. government uses to pay migrants to self-deport. She filled out her information and waited for a response. On the fourth day, a Friday, I received a voice message from Manuela that suggested that she had begun to resign herself to calamity. Her rent was due in 2 days. "He's still in New Jersey, and they're still not taking him out," she said. "In any case, I want to buy the tickets to be able to leave, because this country is only going to get more difficult, more than anything, with the current president. There's no chance of me staying here. I don't have the resources for a lawyer." Later that weekend, I put her in contact with an immigration attorney I'd met through previous reporting. The attorney told her that there was no clear remedy for her husband's situation. A cousin began looking into buying tickets to Ecuador for her and Nicole. He collected $420 in cash from her. Manuela didn't have a bank account in the U.S., let alone a credit card or debit card, to purchase a flight online. When I asked her, she didn't seem to know about travel agencies in the neighborhood, which would let her pay for everything in cash. By the start of the weekend, the matter seemed to be settled. She and her daughter would leave on Monday night, arriving in Quito at 5 the following morning. Manuela told me that she was now certain of her decision. Whether or not she received money from the U.S. government in exchange for leaving. "I cannot stay here anymore because there's no way that my husband will get out of jail," she reiterated. I called Manuela's mother, who confirmed to me that she and her husband planned to leave their small town at midnight and drive all night in order to be at the airport when their daughter arrived at dawn. That Friday afternoon, when Manuela had picked up Nicole from daycare in Corona, she had told the teachers that her daughter would not be returning because they were leaving the country. The daycare center gave Manuela a letter confirming Nicole's enrollment in case she needed it and said that she was welcome to come back if their plans changed. But Manuel knew at that point that they would not stay in America without Ivan. Nicole had a strong attachment to her father, and she never wanted to leave his side. Whenever the little girl asked where he was, Manuela said, "He's working," and Nicole accepted that answer for the time being. Before leaving the daycare center, Manuela filled up a cloth Target bag with Nicole's school supplies and some artwork, and the two of them walked home between the tall piles of snow. "Something happened with my flight," Manuela wrote to me on Sunday afternoon, the day before she planned to depart. "My cousin, he bought the flights for me and my daughter, but now he doesn't want to give me the tickets," she explained. Only after she called an uncle to see what was the matter did her cousin finally return her cash. It seemed that no tickets had been purchased in the first place. "I think he wanted to take my money," Manuela said, though she wasn't sure why he'd do that. Her plan had fallen apart. On WhatsApp, her mother reprimanded her for being too trusting of others, even of relatives. Manuela was angry with her cousin and got very emotional just thinking that he might try to take advantage of her when she was in such a dire situation. She contacted her landlord, an Ecuadorian homeowner who lived upstairs. He told her that she could stay for an extra week, rent-free, because of her circumstance, but then she would have to go. 5 days had passed since Ivan was arrested. According to the detainee locating system, he was still in New Jersey, but he'd stopped calling us frequently. Manuela, who felt more alone than ever, only wanted their American nightmare to end. She had already sold or allocated most of her furniture, a television, some bed sheets, a dresser, to other migrants she knew. A pink rolling suitcase was packed with what few clothes the family owned. This was what remained of the tiny life Manuela and Ivan had tried to make for themselves in New York City. An Ecuadorian and American flag, which she and Ivan had bought at a 99-cent store when they first arrived in town, blocked the basement's small windows so that no one could see her inside. On February 9th, the day after Manuela was supposed to leave her apartment in almost 2 weeks after her husband's arrest, she and her daughter flew to Quinto. The first leg of her flight to Panama was delayed nearly 2 hours on the tarmac at JFK. Manuela gazed out of her window for a long while, feeling a mixture of emotions. She missed her parents, who would be waiting for her when she arrived. She wondered if the U.S. government would ever send her the money for leaving. And she thought of Ivan, who had been transferred yet again to a detention center in California. She wasn't sure when she would see him again or where. That's the end of that article. President's Days, from Obama to Trump. The official oral history of the Obama White House is a stark and extensive reminder of the values and the principles that are being trampled, by David Remnick. In the fall of 2016, President Barack Obama and his aides at the White House made plans for one last trip abroad on Air Force One to deliver a message in Greece about the origins and persistence of democratic values. The trip was planned in a mood of confidence, even advanced celebration. Hillary Clinton, Obama's former Secretary of State, and the Democratic nominee would surely defeat Donald Trump. And Obama, who had won over an immense crowd in Berlin when he first ran for the White House in 2008, would now have a valedictory moment near the Acropolis, where the ancient Greeks originated the business of self-rule. At least, that was the rosy view in the planning sessions. The voters of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Florida, however, with an assist from James Comey and Clinton's own stumbles, put an end to those plans. After Trump won the election, Obama agreed with aides who told him that to deliver the speech outdoors with the Acropolis as a backdrop would come off as grandiose and out of key with the moment. They moved the event to a more modest, less historically resonant venue, a cultural center in Athens. The content of the speech that Obama delivered was not greatly altered, but the context of the occasion had darkened considerably. In Athens, Obama spoke out in support of NATO and post-war alliances. He affirmed the ideals and the institutions of democratic rule, the separation of powers, an independent judiciary, freedom of speech and religion, a free press designed to expose injustice and corruption, free and fair elections, peaceful transitions of power. In the months and years that followed, Trump showed contempt for all of these. But when Obama delivered the speech, few recognized the full extent of the emergency to come. Recently, I've been revisiting that transitional moment, the passage from Obama to Trump, as I was provided early and exclusive access to a rich and fascinating oral history project on the Obama presidency, conducted by Insight, a research institute at Columbia University. The project, led by Columbia with contributions from the University of Chicago and the University of Hawaii, features hundreds of interviews with former administration officials, advisors, activists, critics, artists, and ordinary people. It goes online Tuesday, February 17th. One of the many interviews that caught my attention was with Terry Splatt, a speechwriter who helped draft the Athens Address. "He's not trolling Trump," Splatt points out in an interview conducted over Zoom during the pandemic. "What he's doing, he's laying down a marker of how democracies succeed, what's required, what are the ingredients, the things that we're going to have to defend in the coming years." He never once says Trump's name. The mood in the room in Athens was nonetheless somber. Radical nationalism and populism were ascendant from Ankara to Moscow to Budapest, and now Trump was coming to power. "You could have heard a pin drop," Splatt said. "Those of us watching knew exactly what was going on and what we were listening to." Obama had started out, like so many, thinking that Trump was little more than a comical, if malevolent, real estate hawker. Trump's early and bellowing deployment of the racist birther theory gave Obama every reason to hate him. He chose, instead, to laugh at him. In January 2016, Matt Lauer, then at NBC, asked Obama, "So, when you stand and deliver the State of the Union address, in no part of your mind and brain can you imagine Donald Trump standing up one day and delivering the State of the Union address?" Obama laughed. "Well," he said, "I can imagine it in a Saturday night skit." Even in the last days before the election, as the Clinton team faltered, Obama's campaign guru David Perloff still insisted that Clinton was a 100% lock and instructed worrywarts to stop wetting the bed. Like Perloff, Obama proved to be a poor prognosticator. Not only did he, along, in fairness, with nearly everyone, fail to anticipate Trump's victory, he failed to comprehend the degree to which Trump would, particularly in his second term, set out to demolish the principles and the institutions that Obama had defended in Athens. Obama met with Trump at the White House following the election on November 10th. "Not long afterward," Obama told me in an interview in the Oval Office, "I don't believe in until the apocalypse comes. I think nothing is the end of the world until the end of the world." In fact, he had told his staffers, who were stunned by Clinton's loss, many of them weeping, that sometimes losing was the nature of democracy, that history does not move in straight lines. People were mired in despondency, and he thought part of his goal was to keep people pointed in the right direction. David Axelrod, Obama's senior advisor and political consultant, told me recently, "Our norms and institution have proven more vulnerable to Trump's assaults than President Obama imagined then." Obama told me at the time that he had accomplished 70 or 75% of what he had set out to do, and that only 15 or 20% of what he had achieved would probably get rolled back by Trump But there's still a lot of stuff that sticks. This badly underestimated what was to come. Not only has Trump undermined government institution and basic norms, he has, through his example, through his daily insults and his late-night social media rants, normalized a level of racism, misogyny, and gratuitous division that cannot be calculated by percentages. Here and there, in the oral history archive, people in the Obama circle refer to Trump's racism, particularly the birther rhetoric that propelled his first campaign. Nearly a decade later, as I was watching and reading these interviews, the background noise was, as usual, insistent. There was Trump showering contempt on female reporters and sharing a racist video that depicted Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. This is such routine behavior from Trump that, as news stories, they pass quickly and, of course, with no apology. Out of office, the Obamas have handled these grotesque insults differently. Michelle Obama harbors deep anger at Trump, according to knowledgeable sources, and has made it plain that she wants nothing to do with him. She believed that the birther rhetoric endangered her family, and things only got worse from there. As a matter of obligation, Obama is still capable of sitting next to Trump, as he did at Jimmy Carter's funeral last year, and exchanging banalities. When I raised this with two of Obama's closest aides, Axelrod and Ben Rhodes, they both referred to the analogous predicament of Jackie Robinson, who is the first black player in modern Major League Baseball, and who made it a matter of principle to endure and absorb every slur with an almost superhuman dignity. The Pathfinder's predicament. In private, Obama usually does not lash out angrily about the Trumpism of the day. That is not his temperament. But he will routinely ask people to imagine the response if he'd been the one to, say, rage post hateful videos at 2 a.m. or use his office to enrich his family by billions of dollars. Often, Obama will ignore Trump's daily offenses. When he finally reacted to the racist ape video, as he did on Brian Tyler Cohen's podcast the other day, he did so with a formal, almost serene calm that stands outside the fevers of the political moment. "You know, it's true that it gets attention," he began. "But you know, as I'm traveling around the country, as you're traveling around the country, you meet people. They still believe in decency, courtesy, kindness. And there's this sort of clown show that's happening in social media and on television," he went on. "And what is true is that there doesn't seem to be any shame about this among people who used to feel like you had to have some decorum and a sense of propriety and respect for the office, right? So, that's been lost." Obama's posture towards Trump's outrage is not a facade. As was the case with Robinson, his carriage is a matter of both discipline and principle. In a speech, Obama is perfectly capable of slamming Trump. Many wonder why he does not do it far more often, considering the nature of the ongoing crisis. But he will not alter his nature. "Look, by dint of biography, by dint of experience, the basic optimism that I articulate and present publicly as president is real, he told me after his 2016 meeting with Trump. What I teach my daughters, it is how I interact with my friends and with strangers. I genuinely do not assume the worst because I've seen the best so often. So it is a mistake that I think people have sometimes made to think that I'm just constantly biting my tongue and that there's this sort of roiling anger under my calm Hawaiian exterior. I'm not that good of an actor. I was born to a white mother, raised by a white mom and grandparents who loved me deeply. I've had extraordinarily close relationships with friends that have lasted decades. I was elected twice by the majority of the American people. Every day I interact with people of goodwill everywhere. In Athens, Obama made his speech at an ordinary hall, but still had occasion to visit the Acropolis. There was something haunting about that, Rhodes told me. It was emptied of tourists for security reasons, and for Obama, given his kind of Buddhist nature, the persistence of this ancient place was a reminder of how temporary everything, like a particular leader, is. It was reassuring to him. Trump was elected, but democracy has been around for thousands of years. Obama actually thinks like that. So he took some solace in that. That's the end of the article. The Jeffrey Epstein files are Peter Mandelson's final disgrace. The labor politician and strategist was a great survivor. Then came revelations that he passed sensitive government information to Epstein during the financial crisis by John Cassidy. For much of the past 6 months, Peter Mandelson, the veteran British politician, has been holed up in a rented country house in a picturesque valley in Wiltshire, about 100 miles west of London. He retreated there after the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, fired him last September from his post as the UK's ambassador to the United States, following the release of emails that showed Mandelson had retained close ties to Jeffrey Epstein and pledged his support to him, despite the late financier's 2008 conviction for soliciting sex from a minor. Not for the first time in his career, Mandelson was disgraced, and things got a lot worse for him at the end of last month when the DOJ released more emails revealing that he wasn't merely friendly with Epstein. In 2009-10, during Mandelson's time as a government minister, he passed sensitive government information to Epstein. Referring to the emails, Mandelson told a journalist from the Times of London who visited him in Wiltshire that none of them indicate wrongdoing or misdemeanor on my part. But he's now the subject of a police inquiry into whether his leaks amounted to misconduct in public office, a criminal offense. And earlier this month, Daisy Cooper, the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats, the third largest party in the House of Commons, called on the Financial Conduct Authority, Britain's main financial regulator, to launch an insider dealing investigation into whether Mandelson or those he leaked information to profited from access to this market-sensitive and confidential material. At this stage, there's no evidence that anybody did. There is also no suggestion that Mendelsohn had anything to do with Epstein's alleged sex trafficking. But the Fuhrer has enveloped Starmer, who appointed Mendelsohn as ambassador in 2024. At a meeting with the Labour MP and peers last week, the Prime Minister said that he has no intention of stepping down. But two of his aides who had ties to Mendelsohn have resigned, and the scandal has raised doubts about his long-term survival in office. It has also added another twist to the Epstein story, illustrating his role as an information hub and informal lobbyist for Wall Street interests. Last Friday, two House Democrats sent a letter to Mendelsohn asking him to agree to be interviewed by the staff from the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. The British press still sometimes refers to him as the Prince of Darkness, a nickname he acquired in the 1980s when, as the Labour Party's young director of communications, he proved to be a ruthless but highly effective political strategist and spin doctor. In 1997, Mendelsohn directed Tony Blair's victorious campaign for New Labour, which ended 18 years of conservative rule, and he was subsequently appointed to the cabinet. But Mendelsohn soon proved himself to be a political liability. In December of 1998, he was forced to resign after The Guardian reported that he had taken an undisclosed home loan from a fellow Labour MP who was also a wealthy businessman. The following year, Blair brought Mendelsohn back into the cabinet, but he didn't last long then either. In January 2001, he resigned again, this time after being accused of trying to influence a passport application by an Indian businessman who was seeking British citizenship. An independent inquiry found that, in this instance, Mendelsohn had done nothing wrong. But he couldn't shed the tinge of scandal or the suspicion that he was overly keen on accumulating money and social status. It's not clear when Mendelsohn's friendship with Epstein started, but in 2003, he contributed to a book of tributes compiled for the financier's 50th birthday, describing him as my best pal. This was the same book to which Donald Trump appears to have contributed his infamous note and sketch of a naked woman. In the files, bank documents suggest that in 2003 and 2004, Epstein sent $75,000 in three payments to accounts thought to be connected to Mendelsohn and his longtime partner, Reynaldo Avila da Silva, who he married in 2023. After the documents were released, Lord Mendelsohn said that he has no record or recollection of receiving the payments and did not know whether the documents were authentic. In 2004, Mendelsohn went to Brussels as Britain's Commissioner for Trade in the European Union. Many observers believed that his days as a major political figure were done. But in October 2008, as the financial crisis was raging, Gordon Brown, who had succeeded Blair as Labour leader and Prime Minister the previous year, brought Mendelsohn back from Europe, granted him a life peerage in the House of Lords, and appointed him as business minister. Since Brown and Mendelsohn had clashed in the past, this appointment came as a surprise. Brown said that serious people are needed for serious times. Commenters suggested that he valued Mendelssohn's political savvy and experience in dealing with foreign governments. The following year, Brown further promoted Mendelssohn, expanding his department and giving him the honorary title of First Secretary of State. At the time, bank bailouts accompanied by emergency measures from central banks eventually restored calm to the financial markets. But that didn't curb the public anger at the bankers, who were rightly perceived to be in a no-lose position. When times were good, they made pots of money. When a crisis arose, taxpayers stepped in to save them. On December 9, 2009, Alistair Darling, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, announced a 50% one-off tax on bankers' bonuses. Politically, this was a popular move, but in London's financial district, where many big banks, including some based in the U.S., are situated, it sparked outrage and pushback. In a book about the great financial crisis and its aftermath, Darling recalled how a number of bankers called him up and complained about the bonus tax. The callers included Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. "He was very, very angry," Darling wrote. "He said that his bank bought a lot of U.K. debt, and he wondered if that was now such a good idea. I pointed out that they bought our debt because it was a good business deal for them." He went on to say that they were thinking of building a new office in London, but they had to reconsider that now. Reading Mendelssohn's emails, it appeared that Epstein, too, was a part of the pressure campaign. He had a long-standing relationship with J.P. Morgan Chase, which handled many of his financial dealings, and particularly with Jess Staley, who, as the chief executive of the J.P. Morgan Investment Bank, oversaw the London office. A few days after the announcement of the new tax, Epstein wrote to Mendelssohn, "Any real chance of making the tax only on the cash portion of the banker's bonus?" Mendelssohn replied, "Trying hard to amend, as I explained to Jess last night. Treasury digging in, but I'm on the case." 2 days later, evidently referring to Dimon and Darling, Epstein wrote, "Should Jamie call Darling one more time?" Mendelssohn replied, "Yes, and mildly threaten." Later the same day, Mendelssohn wrote to Epstein again and appeared to indicate that he, himself, had spoken to Darling and gotten nowhere. Crazy response from Chancellor. He appears unmovable. Darling and the UK Treasury resisted the pressure that was brought to bear against them and went ahead with an unmodified version of the bonus tax. Surprise, surprise, J.P. Morgan Chase and other big banks survived this outrageous assault upon their prerogatives. But as Faisal Islam, the economics editor of the BBC News, wrote, the possibility that this backlash may have been orchestrated partly via Epstein and with Mendelssohn emailing advice, is staggering. A spokesperson for J.P. Morgan Chase declined to comment. In the past, Dimon has said that he never met Epstein and didn't know of him before his arrest in 2019. In 2023, J.P. Morgan Chase sued Staley, who left the bank in 2013, claiming that he had failed to disclose information about his relationship with Epstein. The case was later settled. in the Labor Party and beyond, the revelation that Mendelsohn was scheming with Epstein to try to soften one of his own government's policies generated outrage. Advising a foreign bank to bully our chancellor in a time of financial crisis doesn't get much lower than that, Justin Matters, a Labor MP, said. A Labor veteran who attended the meeting of the Parliamentary Labor Party, which Starmer spoke last week, told me via email, "I haven't been to such a big and highly charged one since TB, Tony Blair, came to persuade us of the need to invade Iraq." The Epstein file suggests that the introduction of the bonus tax was far from the only occasion on which Mendelsohn updated Epstein on internal government deliberations or sent him confidential information. In June 2009, Mendelsohn forwarded Epstein a memo from the Prime Minister's office outlining £20 billion in proposed government asset sales, prompting Epstein to inquire about the nature of the assets. In March 2010, Mendelsohn passed along a note about a meeting between Darlene and Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, which included a detailed discussion of the Volcker Rule, a proposal to prohibit big U.S. banks from engaging in proprietary trading. At the time, big banks were worried about how the new rule would affect their operations and profitability. Mendelsohn apparently shared those concerns. Well, I'm going to have to stop here. I have not finished the article, only got about halfway through it. Again, this has been David Murphy reading to you. Thank you very much for listening to me.